Well, welcome everybody. How are you doing?
Good afternoon, it's Stephanie.
I know you guys are not trying to hide out on me. I know you're there. How are you?
Had to unmute the phone.
Yeah. Okay, good. Well, let's do a brief catch-up and wins and progress notes. And Grace, it's great to have you with us live time. Who would like to begin?
Hi, everybody. It's Stephanie. Go ahead, Emery.
No, go, Stephanie. Go. You might have more to share than I do. I don't have a whole lot.
Yeah, I don't have much to share. I'm excitedly happy to report that improvements are happening left and right with my clients, and they're all excited, and they have this new wave of, like, I don't know, desire because they're seeing results. So that's really all I have to report. Excited about that.
What are you noticing? Is there any way to summarize in a sentence or so, what is the characteristic that you're noticing that's different, or how would you describe what's different that your clients are moving in a better way?
The thing that I've noticed most is that they seem less overwhelmed than with all the stuff that they have to do all the stuff that they thought they had to do in order to be living a better life or living the life of their vision. They seem less overwhelmed by it now that they're focusing on what they've already accomplished. It's reworded a little differently than what I've done in the past. And
okay.
So it seems like it shifted them more onto their abilities versus things that are standing in their way. That's what I've noticed most of.
Okay. Would you say that it's more a focus on what the next step is that kind of shrinks the change, or is it more conceptualizing all the things that have been overwhelming in the big picture into a story so it's a more cohesive narrative?
I think it's what you said. I think it's the steps. It's now I have a next step. It's not just looking at this big blob of things. So, I would say that's what it is.
That's something that we want to always remember to do. Two things. One is to resonate with their overwhelm, you know, to empathically resonate, to let them know that we understand how overwhelming it can feel. Then we live together in that new common ground. Then you can look at what's the next step and what's the plan. And, you know, in life, all we ever have to do is the next best thing. And it's a series of next best things. But it's also helpful, I think, to have a kind of a meta structure, a kind of organizer, that if we conceptualize what we're doing as part of an ongoing story, it kind of fits together pieces and parts and creates a cohesive narrative that someone can refer to as a purpose or as an organizer in some way to move ahead.
Beautiful, yeah.
Yeah. And remember the one thing, and we talked about this before, but I really want to reiterate it kind of as a preparation for talking about aspects of a success story this seminar, and after we've done all the roadmap case studies, we have just a little bit more time. You've heard me say this before, of all of the modalities that facilitate change, whether it's therapy, counseling, facilitation, coaching, any of the modalities that foster change, there is one thing that each of them have in common when it works. And the one thing is that they help someone change the meaning that they attribute to something. In other words, neuroassociative conditioning. Because when you change the meaning you attribute to something, you're off on a new story. You've created a change. So I think that's really important to keep in mind, and that's why we emphasize so much together and talk about, you know, the aspects of psychology and neuroscience and really looking at the elements of a story to help someone create change, and particularly the how meaning drives behavior and how state of mind determines the meaning that we attach to something. So a great reminder. Anne-Marie, what are you up to?
I have one client. I tell you, this is my practice client, God bless her, where I've been trying on different parts of the new life story. And we've gone, so I've been doing it mainly for my own practice, like I said, in a bit of a linear sequence, sort of the ROA is the pieces she and I have gone through so far. The biggest, there has been a mind, she has experienced a mindset shift, kind of going from this place of, I'm not making progress, I can't make progress, I'm stuck and not caring, but to a, I'm curious again about what the opportunities are. I see a path forward, don't exactly know what that looks like yet, and that's what we're working on. And for me, for her, the transition, that transformation was enabled by a reconnection to the purpose, to why she is doing what she's doing in the context. She's getting a support group off the ground for special needs, parents of special needs children.
Oh, wow.
It's been very frustrating for her, and she has a partner that's not helping in the way that she's wanting. Yeah, so there's a whole lot of spiraling downward that's been happening for her in this area. And it impacts a lot of other places in her life when this thing is not going well. So sort of going back to the recognition and owning of the story, we talked a lot about what's your mission and what are you getting out of this and why are you doing this and what is it that, what is the difference, the impact that you're trying to have? And she said for her, in reconnecting with her desire to help others, it was an important reminder to her of being in control of the story. And it's a place she wants to be. And it's a, and it's help that she didn't have that she's trying to enable for somebody else, et cetera. So getting back to the kind of the roots for her was very, very impactful. And the questions, the challenging questions that were asked up front to sort of make her, put her back as the central character instead of feeling like all of this is happening around her and she can't control it or she doesn't have any say in it, has been very impactful.
Well, thanks for sharing that. You described how you helped her move from a fixed to a growth mindset, feeling stuck to curious about opportunities. And it's especially challenging, I think, with parents of special needs kids because they can subsume their own needs and their own ideals into the story of what they're doing for their children and forget about themselves and not taking care of their needs fundamentally. So they often need to be reminded, especially that group of people, about their own needs and taking care of themselves as the best way to provide the caretaking and live into the ideal of caring for others. It has to be for oneself first, or you become like the giving tree. Remember, you know, the shell story. Yeah. So that sounds like a terrific progress note. Thanks.
And that's the spiral that was happening for her in her life. Everything else was becoming about everybody else instead of. So starting to bring it back to her has been, she says, I'll run with it. It's very impactful.
Or is that a kind of a niche for you about parents with special needs kids, or does she just happen to have that issue going?
The bigger niche for me is women who don't take the time for themselves.
Okay.
And sort of helping women out.
Fits into that, but yeah, okay.
Yes. Yep.
And now, for a niche, it's a specific who's to help you figure out where to go with your target market. So saying women maybe narrows it down to half the population of the adult world. Where does your niche, what is your specific niche? What specific group of women will you target for your marketing efforts? Because the niche is about marketing only. It's not about specialization. It's not about all that you do. But how do you market? How do you know, for example, who to talk to, where the watering holes are, where they gather, and that sort of thing? Do you have a specific niche?
I do. At least I think I do, so I would love the feedback.
Tell me, Tell me the niche.
Professional women in particular, and professional women who are on the heels of a significant change in their lives. And that could be a career change, a leadership change, their leadership or someone else's leadership, something that really shakes the identity, an injury, an illness.
For a moment?
Please do, yes.
Professional women sounds like a niche, but it's really a generic term, because professional women doesn't say whether you're talking about one of the practicing professions like docs, dentists, attorneys. It doesn't say whether you're talking about business professionals, as in executives, business owners, there are professional coaches. I mean, there's a whole realm. I think you really need to narrow that niche down to be able to market specifically to the group. And this is what I want to say to everybody. Some of you have heard me say this who've done training with me. The ICF did a survey of all people who had dropped out of the International Coaching Federation membership to find out why. What they found was that far and away the number one reason was that their practices failed and they gave up coaching. Well, they went and did another survey, cast the broadest net to see why their practices failed. Far and away the number one reason, more than the next, I think, five combined, was that they failed to develop a niche. They wanted to coach everybody about everything, or they had a generic kind of niche, meaning that they didn't have a way to specifically go to the group who they wanted to work with, to speak to them, to find out exactly where they gathered, where their watering holes were, to cross paths with them. So I would encourage you to drill down a lot deeper and begin, you know, one of the ways to think about doing this is to look at what your area of specialization is, who you want to spend your professional day with, what kind of experience, what kind of training, all that you've had. In my view, a far more practical way to determine a niche is lowest hanging fruit. In other words, who are the people you already have relationships with? Because referrals and clients come from existing relationships. So who are the existing relationships you already have? For example, when I did my transition after practicing 25 years as a therapist and analyst, did an early retirement, and decided to do, I did a wholesale transition, I looked around and saw that the people who were already referring people to me, my lowest hanging fruit, were other professionals who were referring patients to me. So and some executives who I'd worked with in various ways, not patients, but in collaboration in various ways. So I let them know what I was doing in terms of a transition from practicing therapy and analysis to coaching, what that involved and looked like and who was an ideal client. And they began referring clients to me, and some of them referred themselves to me, people who wanted to play a bigger game or expand their business or just some, even just life coaching for the professionals. So that's one way to think about it. Look around, who's your lowest hanging fruit? Who do you already have relationships with, and how can you expand that and leverage that for other kind of contact and referral possibilities, networking. In various ways. Don't forget about LinkedIn, especially a great business-to-business professional Facebook page. I've had students who have mentioned on a Facebook page that they offer a free sample session for coaching, and some of them have filled their practice by the end of the training of the 22 weeks at CTA in doing it that way. So look at all the possibilities of really developing your practice. Does that make sense now, and are there any questions about that?
No, that makes total sense. I think I have a few things in place that I probably didn't communicate very well, but I love that articulation of low-hanging fruit. What's right in front of me probably will help me build, but also define it with more clarity.
Yeah, good. Okay, great. Great. Grace, what's going on?
Hi,
great
Dave.
To have you full time. Great to have you live time here.
Yeah, I know. I have caught up with the sessions I missed, and until now I muted myself because I'm still, you know, coughing
a
lot.
You had a challenge with your voice today. Wanted to check in and
I want to do. I really appreciate this conversation about a niche, creating a niche. And the metaphor of the lowest hanging fruits. And I have a question. If your lowest hanging fruits are people that are, that you know you can help within the extended family, how do you avoid the question of fees and family favors and friends favors?
May I interrupt you?
Please.
Would you avoid the discussion of fees? You're a professional.
Okay.
Here's what I would suggest to, as a way to think about it. Whoever you're discussing professional coaching with, let's say you do a sample session. Let's say you've determine that a sample session is going to be 20 minutes. You set that up. You stick to it. The time-wise, before you begin the sample session, you let someone know it will give us both the best idea of what it might be like to work together in a professional coaching if you had a specific agenda, something specifically that you want us to focus on, and an idea of where you'd like to get to, what you'd like to take away. So that does two things. It frames the session that you're about to have that someone knows is upcoming and has a specific appointment for you and knows how long it's going to be. It frames it as this is a preface to professional coaching. We're both going to see what it would be like to work together in professional coaching. And they've begun to think about what they want to focus on that will give both of you the best idea of what it would be like and the destination, what they want to take away. And that's the place to begin the sample session, is what would you like us to focus on? And then after you have a clear focus, that's a coachable issue. If somebody says, well, you know, I want to look at career change. Well, that's too broad for 3 hours. So what you want to do is look at what would be the first step that you could take that would give you some traction. You know, would it be, you know, in other words, you're going to be listening for, would it be research, would it be whatever. So you're making it a coachable focus, and then what would you like to take away? So you've helped someone frame that in that way, and you've given them the pre-qualifying conversation about it's for determining that. Now, at the end of the sample session, have ready a 2 or 3 sentence summary, you know, based on what we've talked about as an illustration of a broader aspect. I think you're an ideal candidate for coaching and that you could make some significant progress. It would make a huge difference in your life or in your business. Here's what I would recommend, that you fill out the client information packet. If you have a website, on your website, or if you just send it as an attachment that you attach to an email, and have that back to me before our first session, that we establish a standing time, the same time each week, and that we look at a time that's convenient for both of us, and my fee that is a monthly retainer that includes all of the sessions that month, plus whatever material I send and whatever contact in between, and that fee is whatever. And I'd like the client information packet and the fee to be paid prior to the first session. Now, any questions? In other words, think about how when you go to any other professional, doc, dentist, attorney, CPA, financial advisor, you go with a particular set of issues or a discussion about something that you want help with. The professional may ask some questions, and then there's a recommendation. there's a recommendation by the professional of specifically what working together would be, what it would involve in terms of time and money. And then you decide if you're going to do it. Same here. Same if it's a family member, same if it's a friend, same if it's somebody who is referred to you by someone and you don't know them. You need a framework within which to do the work, especially if it's somebody you know. I would say make that framework even more specific. In other words, if you've met with somebody usually at Starbucks and they want to do coaching with you, I would say set it up that's distinct from that, like having them give you a call. You know, do it by telephone. Attend to the framework specifically, especially about confidentiality, that you won't discuss any personal things during the coaching session, and that you'll never discuss anything from the coaching session personally, and it's confidential that someone is seeing you, and really have a clear framework so somebody can do the work within that framework.
Okay. I remember what you said before, by the way, about how to set your fees is like calculate how many months in the year you want to work. But I kind of want to think of what is the going rate out there. Maybe I could ask the ladies what they charge and what, you know, rather than calculating it on what my needs are. And
I think you still need to calculate it, because what you're going to hear is usually way too low. But let's hear, Stephanie, what's your fee?
Oh, I'm sorry. I was trying to unmute.
You're speechless.
Oh, no.
What's your fee?
I wish my fees were high enough to cause speechlessness. Right now, my fees
are... Can't quite hear you. Can you get closer to the phone?
Oh, is that better? That's so weird.
Is that better before when you first said hello?
That is so weird.
That's better now, I think.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's great now. Go ahead.
Okay, my current fees are $150 an hour for one-on-one sessions. $225 an hour if you're only doing one session a month. If you're doing two sessions per month, then it's $150 an hour.
Okay, thank you. Anne Marie, what's yours?
Thank you, Steph.
Mine is very similar. Actually, $150 is my standard one-on-one. And I also have a couple of, call it packaged programs. So New Life Story is one of them, you know, where you're actually buying a number of sessions up front to go through a very specific program to a very specific outcome, if you will. So,
okay. How do they know what the program is?
It's communicated via my website or in person to me. So
okay.
I have a pitch, if you will, for each of the programs.
You have a what?
But it's a pitch. So
okay.
It's not a sell, but it's a little bit of a story, and it connects to this is what I'm hearing that you might benefit from the most.
Okay.
Here's an overview of the program.
Okay.
It's rough, it translates.
Let me follow up on the fee now, because I hear that as an issue. Is Emmy with us?
Yes, I'm here.
Welcome. Thanks.
Hi.
Just a brief update from you and what your fees are.
Well, my fee depends on what the kind of work that I'm doing for them is. But because I'm dealing with artists, I charge them a different rate than I would charge for like a company. So my company clients, I've been charging them around 125 euro. And I think that's now almost the same thing as in dollars. And
yeah, roughly.
Yeah.
And your artists, how much you charge them?
And with my artists, I charge them around 75 euro an hour for the work.
Okay.
And what they use, and it depends. Like right now, I'm organizing them for an art fair, and some of them are paying me in artwork. So I take the equivalent amount in artwork.
Okay.
Depending on what it is that we are organizing. So like one of the artists just...
Okay, I'm sorry to interrupt you. Go ahead. Were you finished?
It's okay. So, like, one of the artists just paid me with artwork, and we made the equivalent of, like, 500 euros for a piece. So we go with how much I estimate their artwork is worth, and then that will be the payment. So that's, it's a little bit different than in cash.
how can you be objective about that? Wouldn't it be better to get an objective third source to value that?
It depends on the artist. So I go on with their sales. So I'm not saying, oh, okay, I think that your piece is worth this.
I got it.
I go with the basis of what their sales are. And then I try to get myself the best deal possible because if I'm going to resell it, I want to make sure that I can make some money off of it.
I see. Here's another suggestion to each of you. And here's what I would actually suggest. I would strongly suggest that you consider a monthly retainer because that more accurately reflects the nature of the work that we do, because you want to probably, in my view, distance yourself from piecework, you know, so much per hour. You go do a massage, you know, you pay by the hour or by the 45 minutes, and, you know, you leave and that person never thinks of you and you never think of that other person. But this is a process. This is something that you're going to be having contact in between time, or you're going to run across something, you're going to send them material. It's an ongoing process. And the process is more accurately reflected, in my view, as a monthly retainer. And I think the monthly retainer can be significantly more than four times what each of you are charging. I think that, you know, I would think of a monthly retainer somewhere close to $1,000. I mean, for a beginning coach, I think you could charge easily $825, $875 for a monthly retainer. Two things I would suggest. One is not to charge something that's divisible by four, because there's four sessions, and somebody, if you charge $1,000 retainer, somebody say, oh, man, that's $250. That's a lot of money. So charge $975 or $1,050. And don't charge anything that has big, fat zeros in it. There are a couple of neuroscience studies that show the left digit bias, that if something has big, you know, a lot of zeros, it's perceived as greater. Or there wouldn't be so many things that were $9.95 instead of $10. So I'd suggest that you charge more according to what you're worth. You know, I would suggest you could easily charge $6.75, and I would suggest up to $8.75. You know, when I began 10 years ago, 11 years ago, was there a question?
Yeah, is that for four sessions, or is that
like
a monthly
retainer? So if if there's five Tuesdays at 3 o'clock, we do five Tuesdays at 3 o'clock. Usually because there's some month that there's going to be a big holiday or you both can't make it. So it's going to even out. It's about four times a month plus material and plus contact.
So like a weekly session then?
I'm sorry?
When you're pitching that, you say it's a weekly session. So it's a monthly charge with a weekly session.
Right, a standing time each week.
Okay.
Same time each week, so you know and predict it.
Okay.
When I started 11 years ago, I charged $10.50 as a monthly retainer. I have a low rate now. My lowest rate now is $11.50, and that's a rate that I hold for people who have done training with me and who are mentor coaches. And I help them with their practices and that sort of thing, and look for exponential return on investment, because it only takes 2 or 3 months to have somebody really jumpstart their practice. For business coaching, I charge $21.50, and for people who are CEOs, business owners, a little bit more complex, I charge $31.50 a month. So most clients, I charge $21.50 a month. And they see significant return on investment. I think most coaches charge too little. I'm going to stop here because I want to get into the material. But I think this is important. At the Coach Training Alliance website, go to www.coachtrainingalliance.com. And at the home page, the last tab, if it's still this way, the last tab at the top is blog. And there are a number of blogs there, and about, you know, 8 or 10 or so down, there's a blog that I contributed about professional fees. And I think it would be helpful for you to look at. It's the 9 or 10 most common mistakes that coaches make in setting their fees. So take a look at that, and if there's another follow-up question from this, we'll touch on it next time. Okay.
Thank you so much, everyone.
Good. Yeah, thanks for sharing that. That's really helpful. Okay, and if there's a clarification or a question, interrupt me, and I will try very hard to save some time at the end for discussion, but there's an exercise I want us to do at the end. So this is Module 9 about living your new success story. So the brain is a really efficient machine. It doesn't waste energy. Simplicity is to take the path of least resistance, to use neurons and pathways already familiar with the task, and the brain inclines toward repeating the old story. And this is how, as we've discussed before, neural pathways are laid down in the brain by early experiences, then repeated until they're etched more deeply, even if they don't work as well, even if they're circuitous routes. When a client is resistant, don't take it personally. They're frustrated too. They're in this groove automatically, and they're in a groove together. You can create a new path. To think creatively, new neural pathways need to be developed outside the cycle of usual experience. Stimulation for new insight is a circumstance where the brain can't predict what will happen next. The catalyst for insight is a novel stimulus, new information, or a new context. So let's look at decision clarification. There's a study here that illustrates this, or an aspect of this. Researchers Steve Booth Butterfield and Bill Rager at West Virginia University devised a study that ran ads to indicate a graphic depiction of what they wanted to illustrate. And here's what they did. They showed one glass of whole milk and how that has the same amount of saturated fat as five strips of bacon. At a press conference, they showed reporters a tube full of fat. It's the equivalent of the amount of a half gallon of whole milk. By making a healthy choice specific and tangible and visible, the market share of low-fat milk moved from 18 to 41% over the next 3 months. They moved eating healthily from an admirable goal to a specific choice and behavior. So when we want to help affect change, we need to help script specific behaviors. When you want to enhance active decision making for clients, limit, specify, clear options, shrink the change. Change always has to begin at the level of individual decision and specific behavior. So here are some leading reasons. Now, this is in your outline. Here are some leading reasons that people resist change. And understanding these reasons can be an initial help for the mentor coach. One is ambiguity and aversion. In other words, the risk of change is seen as greater than the risk of standing still, sort of better the devil you know than one you don't. People prefer a known risk to an unknown risk, even if the known risk is high. To make a change requires a leap of faith. It's a move in the direction of the unknown and the unexperienced, and you have no proof. So remember that when someone resists change, because it could just be avoiding the unknown and not wanting to leave a comfort zone. Also, people feel connected to other people identified with the situation they're in now. Change threatens losing those identified with this current story. And this resonates with emotional bonds of loyalty as well as individual status quo and group inertia. Additionally, there may be no new role models for this new activity, or at least mentors who have been there before. And to surpass those who have been both mentors and colleagues can be challenging in its own right. You can't know you have the competence for a new situation that you've never been in before. Now, this may be subtle, but it can be a fear that people have. They're concerned they won't be able to make the transition work really well. Finally, the proposed change threatens not only people's notions of themselves, but also how they're perceived by others and whether others will respond with support or a competitive jealousy. Now, this also dovetails with what someone has come to do and the behavior that they've engaged in has become part of their identity. So as we talked about with the P and roadmap, to help someone transform the model they're using and how they see themselves is at least as important as the change of behavior, because it means that it will be something they can incorporate as an evolving identity and make that change. So a caveat here is always consider whether the proposed change is a good idea or a bad idea. Sometimes focusing on the dynamics of change and the transition process can occlude clear judgment about whether it's really a good idea that needs to be fully engaged. Especially those who automatically see change as a challenge to be engaged and sort of idealize change may not carefully consider this notion. So let's look now at change and transition. Here are some summarizing observations on change and transition. The change is the event, the situation. You change a behavior, you move to a new city, have a baby, take a job. As we focus on change, as you know, in coaching, we address the rituals of change, the work tools, the SMART goals. Transition now is the process. It's the internal story of change, a shift in orientation, even in self-definition as the P in roadmap. Transition is attention to seasonal cycles as well as the daily weather. We help clients create change and embrace transition to let go of the old story, the outlived chapter, and evolve into the new story. Now, there are four components of transition that I want to consider with you that I think each are important, and each are important for us to conceptualize how we're helping a client through this process. One, every transition begins with an ending. Willingly or unwillingly, an ending. It involves letting go of familiar, habitual routines to establish new patterns. So never underestimate the need and the power of letting go. To move to a new position, you have to relinquish a past one. To do things a new way, you have to come to the end of the way you do them now. To become something new, you have to give up some of the old self. And to transition to a new possibility, you have to let go of something familiar. Secondly, people in transition will create new ways to return to the old story. Can I get you to manage the background noise? There's some kind of shuffling, and if you have anything going on, if you would mute, and then remember to unmute again if you have a question or at the end as we discussed. Every ending is followed by some distress or confusion. This is a crucial juncture in coaching. We help a client conceptualize this as an expectable part of change and transition. Ending, confusion, new beginning. People will resist both the change and the transition. They will return to the familiar. We can reframe this return to the familiar with a client as, for example, a way of measuring progress, a validation of moving ahead, and to be sure that you both believe. Three, the new beginning involves changing how you see yourself, even aspects of your identity. Now, the impact and meaning of the transition may bear little resemblance to the apparent significance of the change that precipitated it. Now, this can be confusing at first, because somebody can be discombobulated by a seemingly minor illness because it shatters an illusion of invulnerability. Another person can take the loss of a parent in stride but be devastated by the loss of their dog. You know, sometimes people are like one tragedy behind, and they kind of defend themselves by being a little bit off-center with that. Now, never underestimate, the fourth, never underestimate the change back pressure from the system. Remember, anyone in a system, whether that's a family, a company, whomever, they each have their comfort zones too and will resist change. Each of them has an error detection mechanism. So it's their self-statement of reaction to change. It's not an attempt to sabotage you. It's their attempt to restore the normal order and not do the work of change. And Jung said, the most important problems can't be solved. they have to be outgrown. Now, I want to talk about a little bit about pre-commitment. We talk a lot about commitment in coaching, but here's a notion of pre-commitment. In the Odyssey, Odysseus and his men are sailing home from the Trojan War. He's been warned about the sirens, whose seductive song leads sailors to destruction, but he wants to hear it anyway. So he does two things. He gives his men earplugs and gives them orders that they tie him to the mast and ignore all subsequent pleas for release until they're safely past danger. This management of desire invents pre-commitment to inoculate himself against his predictable and potentially fatal future desire. He knew that willpower alone might not have been sufficient, and Odysseus knew that no one is immune to temptation. So pre-commitment can be especially useful when it comes to bad habits or obvious weaknesses. Pre-commitment can involve present planning in action against the strength of future desires, or by taking certain options off the table or making them prohibitively costly. Now, let's talk about commitment devices. As we think about an accountability of partnership in coaching, commitment devices may be a consideration. We help our children do this. A piggy bank is a commitment device. Other ways that people counter their own vulnerability and bolster commitment to a better response. Some alcoholics take antabuse, pill that gets you sick if you drink. Others do gastric bypass surgery to prevent overeating. In one study, college students were given the option to create their own earlier deadlines for three papers due by the end of the semester. 75% of them jumped at the chance. Well, now think about that. 100% of them always have the option to create an earlier deadline, and the earlier deadline whenever they decide. Another, this was someone who responded to a blog when my last book was released, freezing a credit card in ice. Took a long time. She had a big block of ice because she knew she had trouble. And people find ways of saving themselves from immediate cravings. One study at Harvard Business School looked at the ways people dealt with purchasing want products and should products. They would devise ways to either put off purchasing or receiving delivery on the want products to ensure that they would do what they needed to do first. So we can collaborate with clients to construct commitment devices to do what's in their best interest. Now, here are some, as I've come to see it, the most frequent mistakes made in writing a new story. One, not knowing that you don't know. Now, how can people know that they don't know something? We believe we know, which can blind us to our ignorance. This, in turn, causes us to be blind to signs that we may be mistaken. To know to ask is half the answer. Two, stopping at the first right answer. When we're solving problems or writing a new story, we may stop at the first reasonable action. Now, this may be a correct strategy, but it can stop us from considering other right answers, other correct strategies that could be even more effective. So we ask ourselves or ask a client, and then what? What else? Now, the number three item I want to introduce by this brief quiz. A couple of you have heard this before. Five frogs sat on a log. They all considered their options. Four, however, planned their strategy and then decided they would jump off. How many frogs were left on the log? Well, five were left because they only planned and decided. They didn't commit to act. Number three is procrastination. Now, I'm talking about some of the broad themes here, the big patterns. Putting off an exercise program. Not paying yourself first. Not saving for emergencies. Not saving for retirement, taking care of others but not yourself. Most of us live our lives as though there were an unlimited amount of time left. We may have little sense of urgency, which can contribute to a lack of focus. For example, when the two-minute warning sounds in football, the team sometimes achieves more in that final 2 minutes than they did in the previous 28, except the Texans, of course. This immediate deadline, a limited, finite amount of time to accomplish goals, focuses concentration and increases efforts. In our lives, we only rarely have a two-minute warning. We play as if the notion of finite time is only an abstraction, something we acknowledge but seem not to internalize. Life is finite. It's just that the game clock is invisible. 4, inefficient energy management. Managing energy is a huge key to success, in my view. This begins with knowing strengths, limitations, your biorhythms, when you perform best, to know how to enter and exit various states of mind, which state works best for a particular task, perhaps to cluster activities that require the same state of mind in your schedule. Identify what enhances your energy, such as anticipation, creativity, pleasure, meditation, prayer. Identify what depletes your energy. For example, toxic people or situations, negative mindset, lack of focus. 5, ambiguity. If you're unclear about what options are available and don't know what it will be like to pursue them since you've not done it before, this uncertainty can add to decision paralysis. In other words, and this is important, I think, what looks like resistance can simply be a lack of clarity. People are more likely to change when new behavior is crystal clear, not vague or absent. For example, eat a healthier diet, save for the future. Those are both really vague and abstract. When you want to help affect change in others, help them specifically script behaviors, next steps. Change has to begin at the level of individual decisions and specific behaviors. 6, too many choices. There have been a number of studies that show how having too many choices can lead to decision paralysis. And at some point, choice debilitates rather than liberates, and somebody retreats to the default mode of not making a choice. Here's an example. It's the classic initial study of decision paralysis. It was done at a gourmet grocery store. The research project offered a display of 6 jams for tasting. On an alternate weekend, there were 24 jams available for tasting. This was a very upscale place. For both of the weekends, customers were given a coupon for $1 off if they purchased any jam. Now, with a larger display, when there were 24 jams, that attracted a lot more potential customers. And they tasted a lot more jams. When 24 varieties were available for tasting, 3% of people purchased. When only 6 varieties were available for tasting, 30% purchased. Too many choices resulted in a tenfold decline of actual purchases. With too many choices, we feel overwhelmed and resort to our comfort zone to do nothing. 7, lack of persistence. The truly challenging, courageous part of change is not the initial decision, not the initiation of a new order of things. It's the persistence to stay the course. A clearly defined goal can help capture imagination and inspire passion. It can cut through the fog like a beacon in the night. One extra degree of effort in business and life can separate the good from the great. A couple of examples of persistence. 141 publishers turned down a guy who then decided to publish his book himself, sell it out of the back of his car. It had a really unlikely title for a book, Chicken Soup for the Soul. 51 publishers turned down Richard Bach to publish Jonathan Livingston Seagull. He took it to number 52. To get what you've never had, you'll probably have to do what you've never done. And Lord Eliot put it really simply, perseverance is not a long race. It's many short races, one after another. 8, not following success trails. Have you said some version of the following? I want to play a bigger game, but I'm not quite sure what it is. I want to create wealth, but I don't have a plan. Decide how you want to expand, then pick success trails to follow. You may want to create a support team, construct an advisory board, a networking group, engage a mentor coach, join a mastermind group. I want to mention just for a moment about adaptation to success, because I think this is one of the challenges that is really underrated. Success is never final. Test ideas out. Revise them. Make it your story told with your voice. One reason to be really clear about needs and ideals and to have a clear idea of your story is to deal with success. It's at least as challenging, I think more so, to deal with success as it is with adversity or scarcity. And my prediction, each of you will have a new level of success that you haven't had before. And I'm including this so you'll be ready for it. The writer F. Scott Fitzgerald had just completed his novel, This Side of Paradise. He was riding high, successful as a writer in every aspect. He just married a beautiful wife, had a storybook life. Then Fitzgerald said, riding in a taxi afternoon between very tall buildings, under a rosy sky, I began to bawl. I had everything I wanted, and I knew I would never be so happy again. The problem, he felt, is that every story must end. And as a writer, that, of course, is what he brought about. He then descended into depression and alcoholism and died an early death. Elvis became the story of success, but it wasn't that story that brought him success. But he identified with the success story and actually lost himself in it. His true story ended as he lay cold on the bathroom floor at age 42, full of drugs and the trappings of success. Two guys who needed mentor coaches not to become successful, but to deal with success. Failure and success are both stories, external stories about events, meaning that you have to continue with efforts and change to sustain success. Either story, failure or success, can change. It can continue, grow, or end. To continue with a success story is to continue doing that which created the success, to evolve with it. After you arrive at success, you can't stop doing the things that created the success and only inhabit the success story, the things having to do with success itself and its enjoyment, because soon then success can wither and the story will change. You can become defined by the story. And I want to say this one more time. It's not wealth, position, possessions, or even a chase of happiness that creates problems. It's when you lose yourself in the chase. So, let's look at creating a new belief at this point. How we tell our stories of the past will shape our future. Some stories get told so often or so much that they achieve the status of becoming a personal myth. If I were just loved enough, if I just had enough money. When you're ready to write a new belief, focus on it frequently and return to it often and in every way that you can. The new belief has to replace the old belief. Create a vision of yourself getting the results from the new belief. Here's a brief story to illustrate an aspect of this. Nathan Handworker put in a new food stand in 1916 in Coney Island. Handworker's hot dogs were pure beef made from his wife's recipe, every bit as delicious, perhaps more so, than his competitors. But he priced his at 5 cents, and other hot dogs were priced at 10 cents. He attracted no customers. People wondered if his hot dogs were inferior. They attributed poor quality ingredients to his product. His sales were not increased when he offered free root beer and free pickles. That just furthered the perception that the value must be substandard. Then Handworker came up with a new ploy. He asked doctors from a nearby hospital to stand around eating his hot dogs while they were wearing their white coats and stethoscopes. And he significantly increased his prices. They began selling well. People assumed that if physicians were eating his food and it were priced as it was now, it had to be good. They became a national phenomenon, Nathan's famous hot dogs. And I emphasize that when we talk about what your fees are. Part of the value that is perceived is the fee that you charge. If your value is too low, then you'll be perceived as having less value. creating a new belief is not an instantaneous thing. It's a process. The value we attribute, the belief, can fundamentally change how we perceive something. Now, the process of changing a belief is just that. It's a process, not an event. It can be planned step by step with incremental progress. It takes however long it takes. It's your process, not anybody else's. And don't compare your inside to somebody's outside. Don't compare your journey, your timetable, and your progress with anybody else's. It's uniquely yours, your story. However long it takes, you can make it worth it. Now, the challenge here is I think you'll always know the difference between procrastination and dosing and timing and titrating. In other words, if you say, well, you know, I'm going to initiate some efforts for marketing, and this is specifically what I'm going to do, and I'm going to start in the second week in January. If I were working with you in mentor coaching, I would say, what if you were to start tomorrow doing that? The choices generate the moment-by-moment life you create. The programming of your internal map of reality, your software, determines exactly what it will be. Now, at any moment in time, neural networks are influenced by three factors: genes, experiences, focused attention. Regardless of anyone's unique brain architecture and individual complexity, these three factors intersect at any moment, at any nanosecond. DNA downloads information from expression of its code. We now know it also goes in the other direction. In other words, our experiences, our beliefs can turn genes on or turn them off to determine a major extent of the expression of much of DNA-based information. Dr. Bruce Lipton summarized this finding, emphasizing that genes can't turn themselves on or off, but adapt to our beliefs and experiences. Now, a last note on beliefs and the resulting attribution of value. On a January morning in Washington, D.C., during rush hour, an ordinary-looking guy dressed in jeans and a baseball cap took out his violin in a subway station. For the next 43 minutes, he performed one of the most challenging pieces composed for the violin, Bach sonatas and partitas for unaccompanied violin. 1,097 people walked by. He was barely noticed, just playing on a passenger platform like an average street performer. Actually, I've seen the film. There was one person who actually recognized him and stopped for the entire performance. His name? Joshua Bell, one of the greatest violinists alive, who regularly performs to sold-out crowds at concert halls throughout the world. His violin was a $3.5 million Stradivarius. In this study by the Washington Post, the D.C. commuters heard a world-class concert, but the value they attributed to Bell's performance was based on their perception. Value attribution is our own shortcut to determine how we judge what we see, even if it's worthy of our attention. Then, the value we assign shapes our perception. Now, one of the things that I think is really important in coaching is to look at the right paradigm. We've talked about that in terms of correctly identifying a feeling, because that boots up a certain mindset or paradigm. But consider how each of these paradigms is a conditioned response to particular stimuli. One is genetic determinism. Your genes are doing it to you. It's an inherited trait. It's fashioned by long-standing DNA copy. If you're Irish, that adds to your temper. Here's another assumption: psychic determinism. Your parents did it to you. Another, environmental determinism. Your boss or your spouse or the economy is doing it to you. The antithesis of each of these paradigms of determinism is mastery. Within our own system of authority, developing our own story. And remember this: what remains unconscious will later be attributed to fate, Now, one of the things I want to look at with you before we move to a summary of some success steps and then doing an exercise in our discussion is to just talk for just a moment about a new operating system. Now, you're aware of how computers have operating systems. Within our hardware, within the hardware and comprising the programs is a complex set of software that contains instructions, protocols, couplings that enable the system to function smoothly. And usually we only think about the operating system when there are problems or failings. Now, our society also has operating systems, laws, customs, social and economic arrangements that comprise protocols and assumptions about how we conduct ourselves. We've talked about the operating system in our minds and brains that create our own personal story. Now, let's use the example to illustrate this a little bit more expanded of your money story. It has a similar operating system with a set of beliefs and assumptions about your behaviors. There are various theories and disciplines that each have perspectives on this system of human behavior that ultimately downloads as our own story that we make uniquely ours. Consider these downloads that operate smoothly within a system but may not work. In other words, there's no failure in the operating system, but the downloads are faulty. They're also known as glitches in the wisdom of creating wealth. Here's some examples. Thinking that if you're not born with money, you'll never have money. Equating education with an entitlement to wealth. Assuming that book smart will make you street smart. Focusing on rich and forgetting about wealth. Focusing on making and spending money rather than on making your money work for you. Not seeing yourself capable of making a lot of money usually results in not making a lot of money. Waiting for motivation in order to generate the energy and personal business plan to succeed. Expecting things to happen quickly. Your money story is a paradigm to understand your relationship in a way also with your life story, your fundamental beliefs, assumptions, convictions, and personal truths about money are the same ones as about your life. If you get behind on your paperwork in your life, you'll likely get behind on your financial paperwork. If you put off doing necessary things that will reap a larger benefit later, you'll probably be doing the same thing with long-term savings and retirement. To find out what you believe about your life, the fundamental convictions that you have, the ultimate truths you hold, look to your money story. Remember the subtle, pervasive influence of the status quo. The status quo can masquerade as the blessing of Sisyphus. As long as you struggle to push the boulder up the mountain, almost but never actually arriving, you're always certain both of your focus and of your work. You always have something specifically to do. This also can translate into knowing who you are. Someone who's trying hard at something that can never be quite done. Someone with a weight problem who always works hard to get thin but never quite gets there. Someone who's always about to do well, become debt-free, but never really makes big money. Or almost. But because of this, you're never lost or helpless because there's always this elusive goal to focus on. You can rewrite programs in your mind. They can be repeated then until they become automatic. Now, I want to close this seminar with two things. One is to look at life stages of success and then do an exercise. So for life stages of success, I'd like you to think with me to kind of move beyond the wide-angle lens that we've looked at some things with to move to time-lapse photography. I want to give you some quotes that really summarize in an elegant way, in my view, some of these different success aspects at different points in adult life, at different developmental phases. First, from Ruby Dee, I Dream a World, about how it looks in a relationship. And this is how she put it, for a relationship. It takes a long time to be really married. One marries many times at many levels in a marriage. If you have more marriages than divorces within the marriage, you're lucky and you stick it out. Now, here's one way of looking at individual success. This is from Goethe. Whoever in middle age attempts to realize the wishes and hopes of his early youth invariably deceives himself. Each 10 years of a person's life has its own fortunes, its own hopes, its own desires. Dreams change. We realize some, relinquish some, create new ones. Growth is flexible and dynamic. Once you achieve monetary success and professional prestige, then you can figure out what's really important. Ideally, if you do it before, then you'll be even more successful and have more of a sense of purpose. Now, here's that time-lapse photo from a different perspective. This is from my favorite essayist, Emerson. Not in his goals, but in his transitions, man is great. Now, I'd like to do a final exercise with you. I'd like you to get really relaxed, close your eyes, and take a couple of deep breaths. Breathe in relaxation, breathe out any tension. Another deep breath in, and a deep breath out. Be aware of how relaxed your body is, how firmly your chair is holding. I'd like you to close your eyes now. And for each of these prompts, to just think about the first thing that comes to mind. As your eyes are closed, imagine you're 90 years old. Look back at yourself now. Look at how things will turn out on your present trajectory. How would they turn out on a different path? Does the difference between the two suggest a change, a transition? What kind? Be specific. From 90 looking back, what do you see that you might have really seen right now but didn't acknowledge? What do you feel about your situation now? What do you want to tell yourself now? For example, any turns or cautions or risk that you should or shouldn't have taken? Keep your eyes closed and look carefully at your 90-year-old eyes, your face, your hand, your 90-year-old body. Look around at where you are. And then who's there with you? Remember, you always know more than you think. Okay, as you open your eyes, kind of gradually come back to focus for us for discussion. I'm interested in your thoughts or questions or comments about anything we've talked about today.
David, Anne-Marie, I have a really hard time with the 90-year-old exercise. It's an area I've always gotten stuck for myself. I don't know if you have any advice for how to facilitate that.
With this exercise?
Yeah, or any time I've tried to do the where do you see yourself in 20 years, it doesn't spark any, you know, is there a path that
how do you
that I'm avoiding?
how do you learn the best? Do you learn best by looking at something, by reading it, by doing it? I mean, are you a visual or auditory or kinesthetic learner?
I'm definitely a visual learner, and I definitely learn it best by doing it, by just getting in the space and living it.
Okay. Then you might try something. I don't think it's a problem that you are not doing that, but what you might try doing is, instead of just simply visualizing, if you're more of a kinesthetic learner and learn by doing, is to actually think about, you know, the words and the experience of what it would be like to be 90. What would you be doing? What would that feel like? What would that experience be? If someone were to see you, what would they see? And to look at getting into how you experience things more readily by doing, and see what you'd be doing and how that would look and feel and seem, and how you'd be thinking and feeling about it. And look at all the aspects of that from a different way that is more aligned with your your primary representational system. You know, it's kind of like for people who are more auditory, when you ask them to, you know, have a vision or to create a vision, their vision may be more of what's the conversation at that success moment. What are they thinking and feeling, and how are they putting that into words? Not snapping a picture into focus, but creating a way of what's their conversation going to be? What are they saying? How are they talking to themselves and to others? What's it going to sound and feel and be experienced in a situation like that? So let someone be true to their style. Does that see if that works and helps in any way? Any thoughts immediately?
I'm still struggling. I yearn for what are my options. I tend to be a more reactionary than, I don't want to say than visionary, but it's.
Okay, if I were coaching you right now, I would interrupt you and say, you just shifted a point of reference from an internal perspective and staying inside your experience, which is where you have to create this, to that of an observer by wanting various options and to respond then to the options. So you moved from proactive to reactive, from an internal perspective to an external perspective of looking at options somebody else is going to create. So that moves you from the playing field to the observer's platform. If that were an athletic performance, it would be called a choke, because you would move from the automatic motor memory to thinking about it a little bit too much, even for a nanosecond, and that would interrupt the flow. And the whole psychology of flow is based on the awareness that we have of states of mind and staying in that state. So think about it in that way as well.
Mm-hmm. And I know that to be true about myself, and it's something I work on. Like, that's, you talk about an old story.
And that can happen. So that can be something you do so imperceptibly.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, the more you're aware of it. You know, what you might find useful is to look at putting this on in the neural conditioning chart. You know, to look at what is the cue and the usual behavior that what happens, how you might derail yourself or stop yourself, and then look at how you get centered and grounded, and then what your ideal response would be. And the more you repeat that, ultimately, it will create neural conditioning. It will create a change in what you associate to. So the old cue or the stimulus will ultimately move to an automatic default position of the fourth column, the ideal. But it will take a while, and it will take many repetitions.
Okay. Couple.
So see if that would be an application that you might find useful to look at it, to kind of deconstruct it in that way, because even a slight shift from experiencing to observing is still a state shift.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Absolutely. Well, thank you all very much. I know we're out of time. We didn't have as much discussion. I hope this was helpful. And anything we didn't cover, we'll pick up right here next time. Thanks so much. And I look forward to, let's see, next time will be the first week in January. So because we won't meet the week right before Christmas, the week right before New Year's. So I hope you each have wonderful holidays, and I look forward to meeting with you for our final seminar in the new year.
Okay.
Wonderful.
Happy New Year. Happy holidays, guys. Okay.
Happy holidays, everyone.
Ciao.
Bye now. Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.